I'm Erica Farber, President and CEO of the REB, and welcome to Radio on Main Street. It's the podcast all about radio. Our current podcast series focuses on one of radio's greatest and most special assets, our on-air talent. As we like to say, radio was the original social medium, and its on-air personalities are the original social media influencers. Now, many of these radio influencers have greater reach and followers than that of other media. They have incredibly strong ties to the local community, and that's based on a foundation of trust and emotional connection. As individuals who entertain, educate, and inform, radio influencers have the power to impact and affect behavior and brand consideration. On a daily basis, they create environments that connect their advertisers with businesses to help drive brand awareness and increase sales for the business's products and services. In our seventh podcast of the series, we hear the conversation I had with the nationally known rock music expert, Matt Pinfield. Matt is the host of the syndicated radio show on Westwood One called Flashback, and he's also host of a show heard on 95.5 KLOS in Los Angeles called New and Improved. Music discovery has always been his passion, and he loves turning rock fans onto exciting new music and artists. Well, Matt, first of all, thank you for joining me. You are truly radio and music royalty. And I mean that because you have such an incredible background. And I think a lot of people don't realize that you have strong roots in radio. And a lot of people think of you, you know, as on television and being at a label. But as I said, you have long, long roots in radio.
Radio was my first love. You know, it was a thing that I was drawn to from the time I was a child because I had a love for music. You know, I mean, my parents, of course, noticed that at the age of three. I didn't want children's records. I wanted my older brothers and sisters' rock and soul records, you know, in the 1960s. And, you know, so, yeah, my roots are in radio. I mean, I loved radio. I couldn't get enough of it. And, you know, my first, like, glimpses into radio were at a local radio station that still exists on AM in central New Jersey, WCTC. And there was a night jock there who played not only new music, but was rooted in oldies, and he was a huge Beatles fan. So I would call him all the time, and eventually I convinced him to let a 9 to 10-year-old kid come up and sit in and watch him do his radio show. His name is Rich Phoenix. And, you know, I mentioned him, I wrote about him in my book that I put out in 2016. I wrote a memoir called All These Things That I've Done, which is named after the Killer song that the Killers actually had written about me when Brandon Flowers had met me that night. And Rich Phoenix came with his wife to the book signing in New Jersey. That's how full circle and beautiful.
Wow. That is so cool.
It meant so much to me. You know, Rob Sheffield from Rolling Stone, who did the moderated a Q&A with me that night, said to me, he goes, you know, you've got so many old friends here. It says a lot about your character. And I said, well, you know, those people mean the world to me. And it was a beautiful thing. And so seeing Rich Phoenix DJ as a kid meant the world to me. And my father, you know, who was a physics teacher in, you know, the high school in East Brunswick, New Jersey, was also the head of the audiovisual department. And although, you know, we were a three-child family living on a teacher's salary, and you can imagine even then, you know, that wasn't a lot of money. My father was very creative, and he knew about my love for radio. So he had this catalog that where he could buy an AM transmitter and build it in the basement. So it was science fair or science. I can't remember the name of the catalog, but my dad bought it, and I like sat there with him and handed him wires, and he built this small box, which was an AM transmitter. And he ran the wire up the antenna, or TV antenna, there in the beginning of the 1970s. And me and my friends would do radio shows from my basement when we ran out playing baseball or doing whatever. And so I had
You were running a pirate radio station from your basement.
I was running a pirate radio station. And it was funny, you know, I'd go to the guys, hey, take your transistor radio, run down the end of the block, because it would only broadcast about a block. I go, see, we're on the radio. And it was so cool, you know. I was obsessed with it. And I joke it's the roots of my being a music and program director, because I would give every local kid a DJ name, because, you know, I listened to AM radio at that point, you know, things right. Like WABC 77 in New York when it was a top 40 station with Cousin Brucey and Harry Harrison, and, you know, NBC, where a couple years later Wolfman Jack was on there. And, you know, eventually I really got into FM radio because of my older brother and sister, but I loved the top 40, and, you know, I wanted to do that. So it was just something that I, you know, you had to be very creative. And so we would do that, and we'd broadcast a block. So, you know, I didn't really get the opportunity to be on radio until like Rutgers University. And I was there at WRSU, and I was so honored because they gave me an award this past year, just a few months ago.
Rutgers did?
Yeah, they gave me the WRSU Hall of Fame, you know, which was great, you know.
Nice.
And with some other guys, the guys from The Fan in New York and PLJ and people that had gone to Rutgers, they honored six people. And I was so, so honored to be thought of that way. Because, you know, when I got to Rutgers and I could finally do radio, I was so excited about the new music that was happening in the early 1980s. There was a whole new wave of new wave and rock and, you know, like that, and synth pop and local bands, you know, that were, you know, guitar bands that were inspired by 60s music. And there were a lot of local artists from the New Brunswick area, which, of course, since then has, you know, one of those bands who actually played my first Rutgers benefit that I put on was the Smithereens, who went
on. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so they played.
Wow.
Isn't it? So, you know, so it's, you know, it's got a rich history. And the Rutgers days were so great for me because it was a place for me to, you know, get better at being on the air, but also to incorporate what was going on in the local music scene in New Brunswick, New Jersey, around Rutgers.
Boy, and getting that award, I just want to ask, must be really motivational for students that are at Rutgers.
You know, they are.
To think about the possibilities for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I went and I spoke to all the people, and a lot of the students came for the award ceremony and the dinner at Rutgers. And, you know, I sat and talked to them all, because I'll always make time for young people. I think it's really important because, you know, for me, I had to kind of go out and search that. Even when it came to, you know, breaking into the business, I didn't really know anyone, you know, I mean, and to paint a good picture of what radio was like, if you were a kid from Central Jersey, you know, in the late 1970s and through the 70s, you know, you had New York and you had Philly. You had these great radio stations in both cities.
Yes.
But there wasn't really much else going on in between. So when I talk to, you know, friends of mine who say, I started a radio in this small market when I was 16. I mean, I would have dreamed to have that opportunity when I was. So the college radio thing was great for me. But and then, you know, I you know, my first, you know, regular paid radio job was WHTG, which was a radio station in Asbury Park, New Jersey market. And these two great guys, Mike Marona and Rich Robinson, decided to put this station on the air and convince the owner in a house. She had an AM and an FM transmitter in Monmouth and Ocean counties of New Jersey. You know, they convinced her, like, hey, we can make some money here and do some good programming, because they were playing beautiful music on the FM station, and, you know, they weren't having too much luck getting local advertising. So these guys convinced this woman, Faye Gade, God rest her soul. She let them run with it. And I heard about it through a friend of mine from Rutgers Radio, and I sent them a demo tape. And that was my first job. I did a Saturday and Sunday shift on the radio in Asbury Park. And then I would take any shift they would give me, like a person who really wants to do something, you know, if it's a holiday, if there's a snowstorm, you know, I'd be the guy walking up the highway with a gas can running out of gas on New Year's Day, you know.
Yes, so
I have all these crazy memories, but it was a beautiful opportunity for me, and I was there from 84 and then in 90 I became music director. A guy named Michael Butcher, who's a program director from HFS in DC, had come and the owner said to him, he met with some people about being music director. And the owner said, I think you got to meet one more person before you make that decision. And then when I met with him, he asked me to be the music director. And that's what was my real entry into the music industry, because that's when I started talking to labels.
Yeah.
And people said, wow, this guy has so much passion for music. I always joked and said, you know, I was looking for reasons to play records, not to play them. So it was one of those deals. And we proved that we could actually get ratings in the market, you know, by being a more adventurous station, but also by having a playlist and playing things that are hits and having form. And, you know, like, so it was a very interesting and it was great educational time for me. And it was being there as music director from 90 to 90, probably end of 92. And then I was program director and music director till the end of 94. And then I went to MTV and became manager of music programming, one of the 10 people. I loved doing radio on the Jersey Shore. I loved the idea of how local it was, how proactive and the people in that market were, that, you know, they would come out to our events, they would come out to our shows. Mm-hmm. It was an incredible community. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about radio, you know, is that, you know, it's that idea of interacting with your audience and making them a part of what you do. And that's why I still love radio so much. I mean, there's so many elements and layers to it. So that was a great time for me.
So how would you describe your show today? Because it's very different than most music shows.
Well, you know, there's a couple different things I do. So it's interesting. Now, I've been doing Flashback for about 12 years. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, my journey in radio, I returned Steve Kingston, who was the PD at Z100. But then Steve took over K-Rock and he really wanted me on the air there. And so it was Steve's idea to bring me on the air. And at the time, I was doing so many MTV shows and they launched MTV2. And I was on both. And they found out they'd done Q ratings, and that I was one of the highest rated VJs with the least burn. So they were like, well, we got to put them on more. So it started with 120 minutes, that late night new music show on Sunday nights. And then they had me doing a version of Headbangers Ball called Matt Rock, which I think Andy Schoen, who's an incredible programmer, and he thought it was funny. The name Matt Rock was kind of like Matlock, you know, like Andy Griffith. But it was a show where, you know, I'd interview Metallica and Ozzy and bands like that and Van Halen. But, and then all the alternative bands on the other show. But I was, you know, I was only out of, I got to tell you, the interesting story is that I thought I would never be on the radio again, let alone TV. I had filled in on MTV with Depeche Mode in 93.
Well, why is that?
Well, because they told me they were going to use me again, but they brought me in to actually program, be behind the scenes, which was a beautiful opportunity. At that point, because MTV was like the biggest top 40 station in the country, right? And it to be a part of programming something that was in the forefront of pop culture at that moment in time was an absolute incredible opportunity. But as soon as I got there, I realized people wanted me to do radio, and I started being asked to do radio specials with, like, you know, like Alice in Chains in Seattle, and, you know, and I was
a great interviewer.
Yeah, and I was very grateful. Thank you for saying that, Erica. It means the world to me. I am, you know, and I loved it. So Steve put me on doing the show. He named it The Buzz. And I did that show for about 10 years. Even when I was in L.A. doing, Farm Club with Jimmy Iovine and Doug Morris and Andy Schoen and Audrey Morrissey, who's been doing The Voice ever since and just has been unbelievably successful. When we did that show, farmclub.com, I was still doing radio. I was doing K-Rock in New York from... Kevin Weatherly was letting me use the studio at K-Rock LA, and I was doing it like I was still on Sunday nights in New York. So I did that show for about 10 years, and I did some stuff at Sirius as well. But then one of the great opportunities for me was doing mornings at WRXP in New York City and working with the incredible Leslie Fram, who I love dearly, and she's, back at 99X and CMT.
Yep.
And she's ruling in Nashville. She's just so talented and one of my favorite people. But, you know, we did a morning show there together for 3 years, and it was such a great time. And the station finally started to get ratings, and then Emmis sold it but right around the time it started to really work, because, you know, it takes time to get a foothold. But we were, I can say this much, we were immersed in the community of New York City when we were on the air there. In no time, we went from like being like the third station people were looking at at this thing called the All Points West Festival with Kings of Leon and Radiohead. And a year later, we were running it. And, you know, I probably did 20 introductions on stage at Madison Square Garden. We just had so much going on. We were really immersed in New York music culture, and that's what radio can do. So that was great. And then, you know, eventually I started doing this show Flashback, which I still do. And it's a classic rock radio show. It's a classic rock show that focuses on years. It almost has a magazine format where you'll hear little clips of films and sports events and things that are going on. And then I'll do a music news hour as well and rock birthdays. So I've been doing that show for about 12 years. And Westwood One has, you know, close to 180 affiliates on it. And then, which is a lot of stations, you know, and it's U.S. and, you know, parts of Europe as well. And I'm really happy to be on stations like The Bone in San Francisco. And then I was in San Francisco for a couple of years at KFOG. And, you know, Keith Cunningham at KLOS is such a great guy. When Marula Media bought, you know, the, you know, KLOS from Cumulus, Keith was like, well, you know, they don't want to pay for the inventory on a on your specialty, I mean, on your show Flashback, but we should create something new that you and I create together. So Keith and I put together this show called New and Approved. And it's a show where it's a top 10 new rock songs that are the top 10 songs in Southern California on KLOS for the week in rock. So we look at what's really popular and doing well.
So do you also pick the music, Matt?
Yeah, I'm one of the people that I pick most of the music there. Yes. Right. Yeah. And, you know, and of course, but what's great about it is it's exciting for me to do a show where I'll also celebrate rock people's birthdays and tell stories behind them. And I'll do album anniversaries and then I'll do interviews. So like last week, it was Chris from Nirvana. He has a new band. And the week before it was Chris Shiflett from, you know, like it varies. It could be Paul Rogers from Bad Company to Royal Blood, a new band to Angus Young. Everybody in the world is, you know, that does the show to, you know, Wolfgang Van Halen with his new thing.
Well, and I'm sure the artists love having that opportunity to have that conversation with you.
Yeah, it's really great. And, you know, they built an incredible studio there at KLOS for me that I work out of. So we get a great visual component and the full interviews air that way on, you know, through the website and through their YouTube channel. And they built a whole new stage called the KLOS Live Stage, which is unbelievable when you see this thing. It's what they put together. So, you know, for me, radio stays absolutely exciting and vital. I love doing my show every week. I get up on Monday morning and start programming the show for the following week, you know, once the show ends on Sunday. And it's, you know, I still enjoy so much interviewing artists, playing new music. It's just, I've never lost the spark and the, you know, the love I have. And I feel very, very grateful to be doing it. And I don't know, I've never lost that passion that I had since I was a kid. I just love radio. And so, you know, it makes sense that I've done TV. I've worked, you know, as a vice president of A&R, Columbia and Artist Development. But, and, you know, I keep my hands in different things, but radio is my anchor and has always been, you know, my go-to and favorite thing.
Well, as you well know, radio has changed so much since you started. And yet you're still talking about that passion and how excited you are. How do you begin to prepare for that show? What do you think about as you're putting together your radio show?
What I think about is, I think it's really important that as a host like myself, a person who's known for being a storyteller and informing people about music, but wanting starts being entertaining. Like there's that fine line between informative and entertaining, and you have to really be able to be both at the same time. So that, you know, I learned once a long time ago that there is, you know, Mike McVeigh, who, you know, helped me, was get hired to do Flashback. I always loved his philosophy, and some of the other guys I've spoken to in radio, people that have, you know, worked on morning show boot camps. But there's like that place right in the middle, you know, when you're doing an interview that, you know, you have the things that's going to be important to the really big uber fans of that artist or somebody, but you also have those people who've never heard of them or aren't really huge fans.
Right.
And you need to find a common center ground. So something works for everybody and it stays compelling when you're doing an interview. But when it comes to prepping for my show, I love to because, you know, if you're going to do album anniversaries and birthdays of artists that have already been established, and a lot of times songs that people have heard, you know, hundreds of times before. The thing that keeps it exciting and means does something so it's different, a different experience for a listener, is to find something really compelling. And it's not so much about the length, because I also love the philosophy that, like, you know, when people were talking about these 15-second breaks or personal people meters, I've heard other major programmers and people that have been involved in Radio for Years say, it's not how long it is, it's how compelling it is, and knowing when out of it. And that's it for me. Like, I love telling stories. Like, I was telling a story. Here I am playing an older Aerosmith song, but telling a story that Joe Perry recently said about how, you know, he kind of clean up after Steven Tyler when he was worked in a hamburger joint. And Steven used to come in there with his other bands from New York, like, and, you know, they thought they had to act like rock stars when they were teenagers. So there's Joe Perry cleaning up after him. Or that Ozzy Osbourne and Tony Iommi didn't want to be in a band together because they hated each other in the English version of high school. Like, and, you know, and Tony used to bully Ozzy, and, you know, how they had to bury a hatchet in order to be in Black Sabbath. There's always a story. There's always something fun or interesting about a song or about an artist.
Well, and you're really bringing the listener into that with information that they would not know if they weren't listening to you.
Yeah, and I want to tell it where so it's like, you know, for me, that's what it is for me. I want to feel like someone's talking to me. One of the most really nice compliments I got from Bob Lefsetz, who I know people will say doesn't throw compliments around, like, you know, every minute. Long time he wrote in his letter when I was doing the show, he said, you know, listening to my pinfall on the radio made me feel like I was riding in a car next to a friend. And I went, wow.
High praise.
You know, he said that, and that was, you know, in the mid-2000s, but, you know, my approach hasn't really changed. I love to be a storyteller, but I love to do it with care, with fun, you know, I mean, or if it's very serious, it's just very interesting, but I want people to hear the songs as often as you can in a different way, or be informative about what the artist is doing now. And I think that's the thing that's always the challenge, but it's also the thing that I thrive and love to do, you know, is to find that information.
You talk about that connection with your listener. Can you share a specific story talks about that relationship that you have with your audience?
You know, there's a really incredible story that really has to do with, you know, Leslie Fram and I, which is one of my favorite stories, because she's talked about it, you know, when she was one of the executives of the year in Billboard, and she, in some of the press she's done, you know, when she made that shift into country, she talks about that one of the things that gave her the edge and the confidence knowing she could do that was when we were doing our morning show on WRXP, there was a guy named Skip Bishop, works at Ariston Nashville. There was no country station in New York City. And we interviewed everybody there, from Jack White I'm just using that as an example. We had every artist on there, and different actors, and Kevin Bacon trying to stump me, and Michael C. Hall from Dexter, you know, like, and, you know, we would do all kinds of fun and crazy stuff. But one day, and this was the story I love, because Leslie goes, you know, Skip Bishop called me, Matt, and he asked if you and I would like to have Brad Paisley on the air. And she goes, you know, because there's no country station in New York. And at the time there wasn't.
Right.
So what do you feel about that? And I said, yeah, let's have him on. Because I felt, you know, he obviously was a great guitar player. And, you know, there's something so that's the challenge. Okay, so you're bringing in an artist on a rock station that was a rock and alternative hybrid, who's a country artist.
Right. And you're not playing his music.
Yeah, we're not playing his music. But the thing that was so compelling was I did my research on Brad, and I heard this incredible story about how he met his wife. But it had this unbelievable human connection. And one of the things that we talked about was everybody's going through a breakup. Everybody's been chasing, you know, their dream or something they want and had their heart broken. I mean, I don't know anybody out there, and if you have feelings, that hasn't been hurt in a relationship at some point or another.
Very true.
You know, so Brad was in Nashville. He was going to school. He was working with his co-songwriter. And about this time, it was right before he started to get some traction, where I was joking with him that all the people that were recording his songs were named John. And I'm like, what is it? You're just writing for guys named John Brad? But, you know, he had such a great self-deprecating sense of humor. He came in and went, Matt, he goes, you know, I've always liked you on MTV, but I think I just lost you half your audience. And I said, no, you didn't, man. I go, but you know, he got in, he played Layla acoustically on the guitar, and one of his new songs at the time, it was called Then, from his album American Saturday Night. And the beauty was, I knew this story, so I got him, I walked him through this story and telling this story. And it was about, as I said, he was in college. His girlfriend from West Virginia, who he was in love with, dumped him while he was away at school. He's pursuing country music and songwriting and being an artist. And he was devastated. And his songwriting partner said to him, you know what? You got to get closure on this thing. You've got to, you're going back for the holidays. You're going back for Christmas. You're going to be in West Virginia. He goes, you got to see what you can do to try and deal with this thing. So he goes back to West Virginia, and his first date with his ex-girlfriend was to see the movie with Steve Martin, Father of the Bride. So the Father of the Bride 2 is out as a holiday movie around December. And he thinks to himself, you know, maybe she's as hurt as I am. Maybe she's hurting inside. Maybe she misses me. I'm going to take my pickup truck. I'm going to drive it to the same movie theater. I'm going to go watch this film. Because he's like, you know, longing for her and hoping that, you know, that she's going to show up there. So anyway, he gets there, 7 o'clock movie. He watches it. She doesn't show up. He's really depressed. He walks out to his truck, his pickup truck. He goes to put his hand on the door. And he goes, it was the 9 o'clock show. It was the 9 o'clock. And he goes back in and he sees the movie a second time. Well, this time he's paying attention to it because he's like, and as he's watching the woman on the screen, who's only an act, well, not only an actress, but she's an actress playing a role.
Right.
He goes, I need a woman like her. I need a woman like that. And he's getting caught up in the story of Father and of the Bride too. Fast forward a few months, he's going to make his first solo record, you know, maybe 6 months later. And he's got a choice of people he can have act in this video. First video. And on the list of actresses and actors, he sees her name.
You're kidding.
No. So he reaches and goes, I want her. I want her. So she goes, they shoot the video, they meet, and now they're married with children. And he married the woman from Father of the Bride Part 2.
I never heard that story.
And people were calling the radio station saying, I don't know this guy, but that's the most incredible story. The phones wouldn't stop ringing that day. So it showed that, you know, you find this human connection with a story like that, something that, you know, people are rooting for you. There's a human spirit. And, you know, and everybody's, like I said, everybody's been hurt. Everybody's, you know, been down. But people love to see triumph. They like to see people's comebacks. And also, you know, they love to hear a good, happy ending. So it's a really interesting story.
And that's great story. You know, you were talking about at the radio station that was playing beautiful music and really wasn't making any money, and you change format. And at the RAB, we advocate to advertisers and agencies about why it's important to include radio in their marketing plans. As someone who is close to the listener, what would you say to an advertiser about why it's so important that they include radio in their marketing plans?
Radio is still so important because it is still, people think that just because now, you know, you have people that will listen to satellite or podcasts or playlists, there's still entertainment and curation. Radio still has that magic, the thing that it always had. It also has the ability to connect in a personal way with either your customers. It means it's the most important thing, especially when you're still programming on a local level. And that can be local major city, that can be local small market, but whatever that happens to be, there's no better way than doing it with radio. Radio is, you know, there's just a connection that people have. They feel like they know you and you're a part of their daily life. And whether it's driving in the morning, you know, and, you know, just you become a part of that thing. And that's why it's so important for advertisers to not forget that radio is still, you know, that incredible entertainer that leaves more to your imagination, but also it's something that's very relative.
Can you share any examples, Matt, of where you've directly worked with an advertiser?
Absolutely. In fact, I'm doing that right now. And it's such a personal story. And it's that I'm doing with Sweet James Accident Attorneys in you know, who's here in California. Sweet James was always a big fan of an advertiser for KLOS, and you know, advertised on other stations as well. But they heard this story. What happened to me in 2018 on December 3rd, 2018?
This is such a, it's a tragic story with a wonderful ending.
Yeah, it is. You know, I was literally crossing the street in Hollywood, not far from where I live. It was a Monday evening. I wasn't intoxicated or anything, you know, and I've been sober now 3 years and 3 months, going on 3.5 years. But at this point,
congratulations.
Thank you so much, Erica. It's very important to me. That's also, I do a lot of service work and outreach when it comes to sobriety and recovery. Yeah. But that night I was just crossing the street sober, literally walking across the street, and somebody was texting and they ran a red light. So as I'm crossing the street, I'm looking left and right and it's pretty clear to me. And when I get to the third lane, I see a car gunning out of the corner. And I literally went up, and the only thing I could think to do was to jump. So I jumped up. My leg was caught on the bumper. This, you know, the person was going about 40 miles an hour. Snapped my leg. I catapulted through, my body went through the windshield. So I like went up into the car. My head went through the windshield and it tore the right side of my head open. And it happened so quickly. I wasn't even aware that happened, but I was conscious. So I went through the windshield, didn't know that. But the next thing I realized after jumping up was that I was literally flying over the hood of their car. And I landed somewhere between 15 and 25 feet away. I mean, it was not measured, but it was far. And then, you know, and luckily I landed on the side of the street. Well, people were still out. It was early enough in the evening, like a little after seven. And you know, they got an ambulance there. And, you know, they said to me, it was unbelievable. But they said to me, Mr. Pinfield, can you feel your toes? And they had to carry me in a tarp because I snapped my leg in half because I had a compound fracture. And they wanted to know if I was paralyzed. So they said to me, can you feel your toes? And I said, yes, I can. And they said, Mr. Pinfield, you're an absolute miracle. You know, you are, someone was looking out for you because most people would be dead or paralyzed from the hit that you took. And we need to get you right now to the hospital, Cedars-Sinai, and see if your brain's swelling, what's going on. They just didn't, so they took me there. I'm conscious for this whole thing, but I'm in some kind of adrenaline shock. And I, you know, and speaking of things like radio and, you know, literally, and people know, getting to know personalities, you know, the guy who sewed up my head was a music, rock music fan and knew me from radio and TV. And he said that he, it was an incredible story because our one doctor go, are you going to use staples? And the other one goes, no, I like this guy. I listen to him on the radio and I've seen him on TV. Anyway, long story short, I had to get a metal titanium rod in my leg. It took a long time to heal. My head was sewn up. It looks really great right now. They did an incredible job. I was in two separate hospitals, first Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles, then a rehabilitation hospital here in Southern California doing, you know, so the whole time, you know, it took me 8 months walking on a walker, then walking on a cane and so much physical therapy. But I considered myself a blessed human being. Like, you know, they would come in every day and ask me, are you depressed? Are you suicidal? I'm like, not at all. I'm grateful to be breathing. I'm alive.
Well, you are a blessed human being.
Yeah, I felt so blessed. So the way that this story connects was people knew about it because TMZ broke the story. And, you know, TMZ aren't, they're not known for being nice and supportive of people. They're known to tell stories. But they like me. So they were like doing a whole thing, talking about how brave I was and my great attitude.
Right.
And put me on TMZ, and then that story broke. And then Howard Stern was, you know, you could tell audibly that he was shook when he read it that I was hit because we worked together at K-Rock and he was upset about it.
Right.
And the story broke everywhere. You know, it was on every news website, People Magazine, you know.
Oh, I remember it.
It was unbelievable. But I'm considering myself really blessed. But the only mistake I made was not really taking care of it with a good law firm. And I only ended up getting barely enough money that was from the insured to cover my hospital bills. It was rough. And I consider that a major mistake I made. And so, you know, I talk about that. So I do that with Sweet James accident attorneys because they were so moved by the story. And I've said that before.
Wow.
I knew they had a relationship with a lot of rock people and music people that I knew and loved radio. They said, would you tell your story? And I said, yes, because I really do wish I had had you there for me because you know, you hear stories about people spilling like coffee on their leg and getting $1 million.
I know.
I get rich off it, but I mean, it would have been nice if for my lost time with work and I mean, I still have some debt from it. So it's like, you know, that's what I learned. So therefore, you know, there I am able to like give people advice on not, people forget that. I think, you know, they're losing sight of, they don't realize that radio is still such an unbelievable connector. And I see it all the time because I'm out at events and I host events for KLOS in Los Angeles. And these listeners are passionate and they feel that way no matter what format you're in, whether it's hip hop, country, alternative, top 40, hot AC. I think that any of those, AAA, you know, people become, the radio station becomes a part of their love and their identity. And, you know, I just think it's really, that relationship with your listeners is such an important thing. So I think that's the one thing that radio can give that many other things cannot, like TV. And I think, you know, things that stream nationally, or, you know, I think without having a voice, a curation, somebody that you can feel some, that you have to relate to or learn from, or feels like a friend. That's the thing that radio can offer that other formats and other ways of delivering music and content can't. So I think that's what's really important.
Can you just finish the sentence, radio works because?
Radio works because, you know, the beauty of radio is that, you know, you can depend on it, that it's always there. And it's, and, you know, it, again, I think radio is just this beautiful thing that can leave enough to the imagination. But, you know, it's like having a friend along with you. It's not only there to inform you when times are tough and you're struggling, but it's also there to make you feel good. And you know, it's an incredible companion. Radio to me is the most, I love radio as much as I always have. And I think radio is really important. And I still meet people. And I meet people of all different ages that listen to radio still. And that's the amazing thing. It's interesting going to a KLOS show and in meeting, you know, a young person who's 16 to the age of 65. And what is the common thread they have? It's that, you know, they love those classic rock songs, or they, you know, or things that are newer that have that same feel, bands that are doing things. And so, and that's also a shared family thing, believe it or not. I'm just saying that, you know, it's interesting how children and generations from grandchildren to parents to kids, there's not as much of a gap in the kind of music and appreciation they have now. So it can be a shared family experience as well.
That's such a great point. So from your perspective, I think the future for radio is pretty rosy.
I do, because I still think radio is important. You know, people that like, it's like everything else. People like to say, oh, you know, radio's dead. It's all going to be this. It's going to be podcasting. But the truth is, you know, there will always be a great place for radio, and people will always have a relationship with it. And I find that. And I think they're a lot more loyal than advertisers might sometimes give them credit for. And I think that's something you need to realize, is that people become loyal to the radio stations and they really care. And you can see it by the people that show up, and people do buy the products and listen to the things that are said to them. They really do. I think there's that, if it's a station that you love, that's the loyalty. And it's beautiful because, you know, here in the Los Angeles market, you know, I think, you know, me in doing the thing that I do with Sweet James X and Attorneys and Dursing, with my personal tragedy story that, you know, obviously I ended up, you know, I hike four hours on a Sunday, literally every week when the weather's good. I'll do 2 hours up in the hills in Griffith Park and 2 hours down. So
wow.
I have a metal rod in my leg, but, you know, it doesn't impair me at all. I mean, I'm very, very blessed, very lucky. And I love radio. And I can't believe next year I'll be celebrating 40 years in radio. So that'll be my 41st year.
That is fantastic.
Yeah.
And I look forward to celebrating that milestone with you.
Yeah, that'll be great, Erica.
As we just heard, radio is a strong connector. And it doesn't matter the format. Matt believes that radio is important and there'll always be a place for it. And people will always have a relationship with it and the listeners are a lot more loyal than advertisers might give them credit.
If you'd like to learn more about radio and its many benefits, we invite you to visit us at rab.com, or you can email us directly at askrab@rab.com. Until next time, it's Radio on Main Street.